Good afternoon. My name is Dave Lehman, and I would like to present a four-part series, maybe five or six-part series, on socialism. Because what we see happening in this country and what we have happening today is a debate, one of the leading debates, probably most important debates we'll ever see, and one of the most important elections we'll probably ever experience in this country. So I'd like to talk a little bit about socialism. Nikita Khrushchev advocated socialism in the United States, not communism. Every communist knows that socialism is simply a transition point between between capitalism and communism. There are socialist organizations in every country, and the Socialist International coordinates the worldwide socialist movement. It's one of the four most powerful groups in the world, yet most people have never heard of it. Although socialists talk about democracy, their real goal is government under the control of an enlightened elite. The Socialist International coordinates its efforts with the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, Bilderbergers, the Club of Rome, and several others. All of them work to establish world government. Their only question is, who will be in control? During the 3rd century BC, Chandragupta ruled the Maurya Empire, the largest empire in the world at that time. His political advisor, Kautilya, also called Chanakya, utilized mafia-style tactics. He was described as India's Machiavelli. Kautilya wrote a book entitled Arthashastra, which gives shrewd advice on statecraft to accumulate power. Kautilya counseled the king to use spies to create crises of rivalry where subjects would fight among themselves, allowing him to usurp control. The book tells when assassinating an enemy is useful, when killing domestic opponents is wise, how one should use secret agents, when one needs to sacrifice one's own secret agent. How can the king use women and children as spies and even assassins? When should a nation violate a treaty to invade its neighbor? Kautilya addresses all those questions. In what cases must a king spy on his own people? How should king test his ministers, even his own family members, to see if they're worthy of trust? When must a king kill his own prince, his own son, who is heir to the throne? How does one protect a king from poison? We go to the next couple of slides, and we find there is a fellow named, he basically showed what it's like, it was Yuri Bezumov, was a KGB agent stationed in India who defected in 1970. To the U.S. Embassy in Greece and was given asylum in Canada in 1984, he gave an interview with G. Edward Griffin, revealing Soviet fifth column subversion techniques. The main emphasis of the KGB is a slow process, which we call ideological subversion. It's a great brainwashing process, which goes very slow and is divided into four basic stages. The first one being demoralization. It takes 10 to 15 to 20 years to demoralize a nation. Marxist-Leninism ideology is being pumped into students without being challenged or counterbalanced by the basic values of Americanism. The next slide talks about, even if you start right now educating a new generation of Americans, it will still take 15 to 20 years to turn the tide of ideological perception. They are programmed. You cannot change their mind, even if you expose them to authentic information. Even if you prove that white is white and black is black, you cannot change the basic perception and ideological behavior. The demoralization process in the United States is basically completed. Actually, it's overfulfilled. Not even Comrade Andropov in 1911 to 1984 and all his experts would even dream of such a tremendous success. Most of it is done by Americans to Americans. Thanks to the lack of moral standards, exposure to true information does not matter anymore. A person who is demoralized is unable to assess true information. Even if I take him by force to the Soviet Union and show him concentration camps, he will refuse to believe it. until he's going to receive a kick when a military boot crashes on him. Then he will understand, but not before that. According to Machiavelli, if a prince wanted to conquer a city, in his quest to unify Italy, the people would hate him. But if the prince secretly paid agitators and criminals under the table to burn barns, kill cows, smash windows, set buildings on fire, thus creating crisis and terror in the streets, the people would cry out for help. The prince would come in, get rid of the useful idiot criminals that he'd hired, and nobody would know the better for it. The naive citizens, unaware of his subterfuge, would praise him as a hero. Machiavelli wrote that in politics, one must consider the final result. In other words, the end justifies the means. Standards of right and wrong are subject to whatever benefits those in power. Since every criminal and ambitious politician defines good as benefiting themselves or advancing their agenda, and therefore it gives them license to lie under oath, deceitfully usurp freedoms, and commit the most horrible injustices and atrocities, the end of one prince controlling of all of Italy was such a good end that it means necessarily to get there, any way to get there is justified. In numerous Democrat-run cities across America, homeless persons were allowed to camp on the streets. During the COVID pandemic, these cities released criminals, including MS-13 gang members who illegally crossed borders or ISIS members who accompanied unvetted Middle Eastern immigrants. Soon, crime increased, compounded by the defunding of the police, COVID responses also closed schools, releasing high school and college students indoctrinated with hate America views and organized by leftist professors to participate in indivisible Antifa protests. And if churches were shut down, pro-life conservatives would have difficulty organizing. Statistically, pro-life, pro-family, pro-business citizens are higher percentage Republican. If these people leave, who's left in the cities? Republicans leave and Democrats end up with a monopoly on the city politics. Voter fraud would be more feasible in situation in elections. Whoever wins the big cities usually wins the state, and whoever wins the state gets all of the electoral votes for the state, and the president is elected by electoral votes. This is clear Democratic political advantage to have crime and unemployment go up in the big cities. The end justifies the means. Hitler used brown shirts to create crises by disrupting the meetings of his opponents. Once in power, Hitler had the brown shirts killed in the Night of the Long Knives, and the people praised Hitler for restoring order. Hegel taught, the state is God walking on earth. We must worship the state, all the worth which a human being possesses. He possesses only through the state. The state recognizes no authority but its own, acknowledges no abstract rules of good and bad. The nation state is therefore absolute power on earth. Harry S. Truman stated in March 1946, he said, dictatorship is founded on the doctrine that the individual amounts to nothing. The state is the only thing that counts, and that the men and women and children are put on earth solely for the purpose of serving the state. Under G.F.W. Hegel's system, the general will is determined by the ruler. The philosophy of history that he wrote, Hegel was against the citizens ruling themselves. He wanted power to be in the hands of one person. Students at the University of Berlin who admired Hegel formed a radical student group called the Young Hegelians, a member of which was Karl Marx. Marx got his idea of the government of God as God from Hegel. And Machiavelli's capitalizing on these. He capitalized on crises to consolidate control. And this was adapted by Hegel into the Hegelian dialectics. It can be described as a triangle. One corner is the thesis. The opposite corner is the antithesis. And the top corner is the synthesis. Hegel's dialectic struggle influenced Darwin in his development of his theory of origin, of evolution, and its survival of the fittest. And Hitler, who titled his book Mein Kampf, My Struggle. Karl Marx translated Hegelian dialectics into a political application where people who are accepting the status quo, that's the thesis, are subjected to a created crisis that is really bad, that's the antithesis, so that they will be relieved to surrender their freedoms for a solution that is only half as bad, that's the synthesis. Each synthesis then becomes the new thesis, and the process is repeated until all power is voluntarily relinquished by the people into the hands of a dictator who promises big government solutions. To create an antithesis, there needs, of course, to be a division in society. The revolution needs an enemy. The revolution needs for its development its antithesis, and if enemies were lacking, they had to be fabricated. To create division, citizens must be made to stop thinking of themselves as citizens. Instead, be made to identify with subgroups which are pitted against one another to create division, the antithesis. The subgroups can be social, ethnic, racial, sexual, economic, or religious. The issue is never the issue. The issue is always the revolution. In other words, civil rights or women's rights is never the real cause. Women, blacks, are only instruments of a larger cause, which is power. Battles over rights and other issues, according to Alinsky, should never be seen as more than occasions to advance the real agenda, which is the accumulation of power. The American Negro is nothing but political football, and the white liberals control the ball through false promises. Once a country is divided into subgroups or victims or oppressors, the haves or the have-nots, crisis incidents could be manufactured between them to destabilize the nation. And when people panic and fear, they surrender their freedoms to whoever promises to restore order. Marxist philosophy influenced Vladimir Lenin's Social Democratic Party and Joseph Stalin's Union of Soviet Socialistic Republics, Benito Mussolini's Italian Socialist Party, Mao Zedong's Socialist Education Movement, and the Communist Party of China, and also Adolf Hitler's Nationalist Socialist Workers' Party. Pastor Richard Wurmbrand, after only 2 months after the communists took over Romania, he was arrested, labeled a prisoner number one. He was locked in solitary cell where he endured horrendous torture at the hands of the brutal secret police. He wrote a book called Marx and Satan. While he was in prison, he had to stare at a screen for something like 14 or 16 hours a day, telling him that communism is good, Christianity is bad. And Richard Wurmbrand's book about Karl Marx, and it was a German revolutionary socialist, begins with a rebuttal to this misconception. Marx was not a compassionate visionary who truly cared about the poor. In fact, Marx writes, the abolition of religion as an illusionary happiness of man is a requisite for real happiness. Marx was anti-religious because religion obstructed his goal. He said, I wish to revenge myself against the one who rules above. What produced his hatred of God? No personal motive is known. His parents were supposedly Christian. But nothing but revenge is left to me, he says. I will build my throne high overhead. Those words remind us of Lucifer's proud boast. I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God, Isaiah 14:13. There exists a satanic church, which apparently Hitler belonged to. One of its rituals was a black mass, which satanic priests recite at midnight, and orgy follows. The hellish vapors rise and fill my brain, Marx said. See the sword? The prince of darkness sold it to me. The Bible, which Marx had studied in his high school years, says that the devil would be bound by an angel and cast into a bottomless pit. Well, Marx wished to draw the whole of mankind into this pit reserved for the devil and his angels. Marx had loved the words of Mephistopheles in Faust, everything in existence is worth being destroyed, everything, including the proletariat and the comrades. Marx quoted these words. Stalin acted upon them and destroyed even his own family. In his poem, Human Pride, Marx admits that his aim is not to improve the world, revolutionize or reform it, but simply to ruin it and enjoy it being ruined. Marx is only Satan's mouthpiece when he utters in his poem Invocation of the One in Despair the words, I wish to avenge myself against the one who rules above. We look at Lenin. He says, you must make an example of these people. Hang publicly so the people see it. At least 100 gulags, rich bastards, and known bloodsuckers. Punish them, publish their names, seize all their grain, single out the hostages. Per my instructions in yesterday's telegram, do all this so that for miles around, people see it, understand it, tremble, and tell themselves, we are killing the bloodthirsty gulags and that we will continue to do so. This is a letter, yours, Lenin. P.S. Find tougher people. Lenin had not anticipated that killing off the gulag farmers would devastate the food production. As a result, it created horrendous national famine from 1921 to 1922, in which the estimated 5 million starved to death. Lenin killed some of his own followers, writing in party organization and party literature. In 1924, after years of tormenting headaches, Lenin died. Though he and Stalin had clearly been political opponents, Stalin doctored a fake photo and circulated it to make it look as though he and Lenin were good friends. Stalin rewrote history, tearing down statues and renaming streets, museums, and ships, even changing the name of St. Petersburg to Leningrad. Under Stalin's iron fist, Soviet dictatorship, privacy was non-existent, press was censored, free speech disappeared, health care was rationed, economy was regulated, private industry was collectivized, political dissent was punished, media and entertainment were propagandized, children's education became indoctrination, marriage and families were subject to social engineering, religion was suppressed, and human life was valued only by its usefulness to serve the Soviet society. To stay in power, Stalin conducted purges and orchestrated famines, resulting in an estimated 40 million deaths. Fear and food were tools of control. People were kept in constant fear that the government agencies monitoring them would be falsely accuse them and drag them away at night. And people were kept in continual food shortage so they couldn't have the resource to rebel. Stalin engineered a food shortage that killed millions of anti-Stalinist peasants. To break the resistance of the peasants in the Ukraine, the North Caucasus, and Kazakhstan, Stalin inflicted on these areas in 1932 to 1933 an artificial famine, shipped out all the food from the entire districts, deployed the army to prevent the starving peasants from migrating in search of nourishment. It is estimated that between 6 and 7 million people perished in this man-made catastrophe. In his Great Purge in 1936 to 38, Stalin executed an estimated 1.2 million Communist Party members, government officials, military leaders, and peasants who were accused of being disloyal. The Ukraine famine under Stalin was a nightmare. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the one who was arrested under Stalin's regime, was born on December 11, 1918. Next slide. He was detained for writing a letter criticizing Stalin and spent 11 years in the Gulag labor camps. He began secretly compiling horror stories of life in the Gulags for several years of his imprisonment, 1947 to 1952. He was denied paper and pen, so he had to compose and memorize the chapters as poems. He put these accounts into his book, The Gulag Archipelago. Archipelago is a chain of islands in the ocean. Solzhenitsyn used this metaphor to describe a chain of FEMA-styled citizen detention camps across Russia. Pol Pot's communist regime, along with others, was one that had these horrendous camps. They were used by Hitler's National Socialist Studies, Pol Pot's communist Khmer Rouge, the Communist Chinese, and North Korea. Alexander, North Korean Gulag prisons were also used. Alexander Solzhenitsyn's writings were smuggled out of the Soviet Union and translated. They quickly became internationally popular, leading him to receive a Nobel Prize for Literature in 1970, even though he was still in the USSR. International pressure finally led to Solzhenitsyn being expelled from Russia on February 12, 1974. Solzhenitsyn addressed Harvard, June 8, 1978. In Soviet society, he said, there is a multitude of prisoners in our camps who are termed criminals, but most of them have never committed any crime. They are merely tried to defend themselves against a lawless state by resorting to means outside the legal framework. Warning naive American students of the horrible realities of socialism, Alexander Solzhenitsyn stated in Washington, D.C. on June 30th, 1975, in the pre-revolutionary Russia, there were attempts on the Tsar's life. During these years, about 17 persons a year were executed. The Cheka, Lenin's communist secret police, in 1918 and 1919 executed without trial more than 1,000 persons a month. At the high point of Stalin's terror in 1937 to 38, more than 40,000 persons were shot per month. Solzhenitsyn explained how the government health care provided cover for Stalin's political opponents to be diagnosed with psychiatric problems and given compulsory treatment. Solzhenitsyn stated in June of 30th, 1975, it's not a detente, a lessening of tension. If we have here, we can spend our time agreeably while over there people are groaning, dying under psychiatric hospitals. Doctors were making their evening rounds, injecting people with drugs which destroyed their brain. There are tens of thousands of political prisoners in our country under compulsory psychiatric treatment. Well, are you sick and tired of your calm, peaceful life? Are you sleeping well at night? Is your city too safe? No, not anymore. Introducing Democrats, politicians so incompetent they will fill your neighborhood with riots, looting, rampant violence, and even homelessness. The secret is a special blend of corruption and good old-fashioned stupidity. No more pesky law and order. When Democrats are in charge, nobody's safe. Simply vote Democrats. Sit back and watch your neighborhood burn to the ground. But wait, vote for Democrats and now, and they will include rolling blackouts, election fraud, cancel culture, taxes, and more taxes. Democrats bringing chaos right to your front door. Kamala Harris believes in confiscating America's firearms by force. She will ban fracking in the Alaskan pipeline, change guidelines to suppress the availability of red meat to consumers, ban offshore explorations and drilling, legalize illegal aliens, abolish ICE, and let convicted murderers and terrorists have their vote. Now she is saying she will fix prices on food. This is pure socialism and will result in food producers not producing food because they will lose money. There will be no bread on the shelves, no meat, no eggs, no vegetables, no necessity of any kind eventually. Trevor Loudon says her father was a Marxist. Her mother was a radical left-wing activist. She will open the borders and destroy our immigration system. She will completely destroy the middle class and indoctrinate our kids. She will come after anyone who stands in her way. I'm not making this up. I've got documentation to back up all of this. Tim Walz, a Minnesota bar owner, said Tim Walz forced her into bankruptcy with COVID closures, $300,000 in legal fills, Governor Tim Walz's restrictive pandemic-era lockdowns in the state decimated local businesses and caused financial ruin for those who stood up for their livelihoods. I think he's an evil man who overstepped his role. He took small businesses and ripped them up. He destroyed us, says Lisa Zarza. She told it in the Post. I have to leave the state to be able to legally work and make a living. By eliminating the availability of oil and gas, which we have in abundance, this team will destroy the middle class, take away money used to buy and build weapons to defend ourselves, and make us vulnerable to takeover by China or Russia. Kamala's policy positions go public. She's not going to like it when her plans include fighting to set up murderers free, more taxes to ensure the middle class pays their fair share, abolish borders, bring back the Green New Deal. Kamala believes in freedom for individuals associated with violent behavior, formerly referred to as violent criminals, ending the wrong-headed thinking that more police will mean safer communities and eliminate private health care insurance. Not only does Kamala Harris own the weaknesses, failure, and chaos of the Harris-Biden administration, she is so radical that she makes the squad look like moderates. She wants to abolish our borders, let criminals control our streets, surround our communities with surrender our communities to cartels and the plague of fentanyl. She may not say this openly, but if you look at her statements that she's made, finally launched, this is her public policy, launched one day before the debate on her campaign website. Just ahead of this, she says, this debate with Donald Trump And over a month after she became the Democratic nominee, Harris doubled down on price controls and support for the border bill that would allow 1.4 million illegal immigrants into the country each year. She also backed gun bans, promised to advocate environmental justice, and to end the suffering in Gaza, among other leftist positions. According to the issue's selection of Harris website, she has doubled down on almost everything. Grocers usually operate on razor-thin profit margins, 1 to 3%, and raise or lower their prices in tandem with supply and demand, as the market is very competitive. There's in Harris' radical agenda, she says, there's no question I'm in favor of banning fracking. While many have criticized the critical proposed policy as it could lead to shortages like price control policies and other things that are counterwise that are in other countries such as Soviet Union, Venezuela, and other places. But last month's CNN contributor said, we've seen this kind of thing tried in lots of other countries before. Venezuela, Argentina, the Soviet Union, other legacy media outlets ripped into Harris for proposing this policy. Well, we see this is what we see the difference between what's going to be in the debate. Now, she may say that she is for the very things that Trump says, but her history, her legacy goes against that idea. Lying has been something that Democrats in general use to gain support, and then they go back to their original beliefs. Before the China, this is the Trump administration accomplishments. I'd like to look at some of those. Before the China virus invaded our shores, we built our world's most prosperous economy. America gained 7 million new jobs, more than three times the government experts' projections. Middle-class families' income increased nearly $6,000, more than five times the gains during the entire previous administration. The unemployment rate reached 3.5%, the lowest in half a century. It achieved in 40 months in a row, with more job openings than job hirings. More Americans reported being employed than ever before, nearly 160 million. Jobless claims hit a nearly 50-year low. The number of people claiming unemployment insurance as a share of the population hit its lowest on record. Incomes rose in every single metro area in the United States for the first time in three decades. He delivered future and greater promise and opportunity for citizens of all backgrounds. Unemployment rates for African Americans, Hispanic Americans, Asian Americans, Native Americans, veterans, individuals with disabilities, and those without high school diploma all reached record lows. Unemployment for women hit its lowest rate in nearly 70 years, lifted nearly 7 million people off the food stamps. Poverty rates for African Americans and Hispanic Americans reached record lows. Income inequality fell for two straight years and by the largest amount in over a decade. The bottom 50% of American households saw a 40% increase in net worth. Wages rose fastest in low-income and blue-collar workers, a 16% pay increase. African-American home ownership increased. So just a small matter, and this could go on for quite a bit of that, several notes on that. But God, Trump, and America, the Democrats all out plan to steal the 2024 election. And this is basically what they see. It's their only hope, because Trump will reverse everything that they've gained. However unspeakably bad everything has gotten during the administration of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, one reality remains unchanged. Today's far-left Democratic Party is single-mindedly obsessed with retaining and expanding its power no matter what. And that means Democrats, in close collaboration with the deep state, the legacy news media, big tech, and other corporate allies, will do absolutely anything and everything within their power to rig, corrupt, and steal the 2024 election. And of course, to bring things back to stark present-day reality, the Democrats, with their atrocious track record and equally atrocious candidates, have nothing else going for them in the 2024 election other than lying, defaming, and cheating in every possible way. Democrats and their leftist allies are attempting to defeat a successful former president with an impressive track record, but about whom they have lied continually for 8 years, impeached twice, subjected to an unprecedented, scandalous, illegal lawfare campaign intended to imprison him for the rest of his life, and who just 2 weeks ago narrowly escaped an assassination attempt. The Republican candidate Donald Trump said on Thursday he would establish a government efficiency commission headed by billionaire supporter Elon Musk. This, if he wins the November 5th election, during that wide-ranging speech in which he laid out his economic vision. So much corruption is going on in our government. Someone like Elon Musk would be the perfect person to get rid of that. The former president has been discussing this idea of this government efficiency commission. He said that Musk has agreed to head the body. He did not detail precisely how the commission would operate, besides saying it would develop a plan to eliminate fraud and improper payments with 6 months of being formed. I will create a government efficiency commission tasked with conducting a complete financial and performance audit of the entire federal government and making recommendations for drastic reforms. Of course, those stealing from the government are going to be against that. Trump also is going to have RFK head a health food department. This is really important because 29% of the net federal outlays for fiscal year 2023 came from global health programs. So the health HHS over, agencies, it oversees 13 agencies, including the Food and Drug Administration, the Centers for Disease Control, the Prevention and National Institutes of Health. And on the campaign trail, in podcasts and in news interviews, Kennedy has described wanting to dismantle those offices and rebuild them with like-minded fringe figures. He has been very much against Anthony Fauci, former director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, for COVID's death toll, and said Fauci should be prosecuted. So he's the perfect person to head that department. Also, we found that Elon Musk has come up with a $10,000 house, which is interesting. So many of us could be afford to actually have a home. And he goes through in details and describes how this actually state of the art. You could have a $10,000 house. They're being made right now, and you can add to it as well. Now we go back and look near the end of World War II. In declining health, President Roosevelt attended a Tehran conference and then a Yalta conference, where he surrendered half of Europe to the iron-fisted control of the Union of Soviet Socialistic Republics, led by communist dictator Stalin. Now, this communist replaced the Christian religion with materialistic atheism. Church property was confiscated or destroyed. Free speech and free press were prohibited. Private property was abolished. We look at North Korea gulag prisoners. We see what happened to the Chinese gulag prisoners. And we look at somebody like Dean Clarence Mannion. Dean Clarence Mannion was part of the John Birch Society, but he was dean of the Notre Dame Law School. He was chosen by President Dwight D. Eisenhower to chair a commission to return to the state powers that had been usurped by the federal government during Roosevelt's New Deal era. Eisenhower was persuaded to decline Mannion's recommendations in favor of a Republican big government. Mannion was released from the administration, but continued his cause, writing the Constitution of the United States versus Communism. In November 19, 1962, he wrote, "Never before in the history of the human race has atheism, naked, materialistic, power-hungry, activated atheism, ever mounted its horse and started to ride across the world and do so successfully. Communism is this activation of atheism. This is the personalization of anti-God. This is Armageddon, and anybody in this room who has a shred of belief in God or immorality or in his or her personal responsibility must recognize that understanding and the defeat of communism is the first order of business on the part of everyone who has a shred of interest in the perpetuation of Christian civilization. This thing must be destroyed," Mannion pioneered conservative talk radio with during the 1950s and 60s, influencing leaders such as California Governor Ronald Reagan Guests on Mannion's radio program include Governor Douglas MacArthur, Jesse Helms, Strom Thurmond, Harry Byrd Sr., Barry Goldwater, Henry Regnery, Stan Evans, and Phyllis Schlafly. The Cold War was at its height in 1947 to 1991, with nuclear attacks prevented by the mutually assured destruction, MAD, and proxy wars fought between the U.S. and USSR and China. Countries experienced their political parties infiltrated, communist parties being established, coup d'etat plots to remove leaders, and military conquests. During this time, 45 countries became communist satellites, often with brutal purges which killed millions. Countries included Afghanistan, Albania, Angola, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Belarus, Benin, Bosnia, Bulgaria, Cambodia, China, Congo, Cuba, Croatia, Czech Republic, East Germany, Egypt, Estonia, Ethiopia, Georgia, Indonesia, Hungary, Kazakhstan, Laos, Lebanon, Lithuania, Moldova, Mongolia, Mozambique, Nicaragua, North Korea, Poland, Romania, Russia, Serbia, Ukraine, Vietnam, Yemen, Yugoslavia, and many others. What would they do? They would, their main tactic of takeover was they would find groups within a country with grievances, organize these groups to protest and riot, escalate riots to violence and bloodshed. They would bribe, threaten, and co-opt the media to control the narrative, blaming the existing leadership. In the midst of the national confusion, they would carry out a coup or a rigged election, overthrowing the country's representative government and replacing it with a totalitarian dictatorship. Citizens are initially relieved that order is restored, but when the dust settles, they realize they have a rude awakening and find their freedoms gone. The USSR's Committee for State Security, the KGB, organized clandestine opposition groups to destabilize pro-Western countries. And that will be the end of my talk for this afternoon.